好，okay, so what I want to talk to. Okay, let me redo that. 3, 2, 1, go. So what I want to talk about today is innovation and how that affects the economy, how that affects your investments, how that affects finance and all of this. And innovation is one of the most important parts of capitalism. And that's why capitalism works so much better than something like socialism or communism does. You know, one reason of it is because all of the innovation. And, you know, something like the Soviet Union, I mean, there was basically no innovation there. And they had rocket ships, and they were trying to, you know, invent all of this space technology, but that was not very appropriate for their situation. Like, their people were basically starving, and these guys are trying to come up with some new, you know, space, you know, type of space force, some type of military that could benefit off of space. They were making all these satellites, but their people were starving. And so that was not a very appropriate time to innovate. And they were allocating their capital to innovate the wrong things. But innovation in general, when you have basically met the basic needs and you want to kind of break through into a new level, innovation is great. And so today, what we have here is, I want to talk a little bit about innovation. And when you're talking about innovation, and you're also talking about stuff like finance or investing, you know, Cathie Wood is it's obviously a big name. And let me tell you, personally, we have quite different strategies. Now, she's a lot more experienced than I am. She has a lot more capital than I do, obviously. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, compare myself to her, because I mean, I bet she's a lot smarter than I am. But I'm trying to kind of understand her strategy. And I was looking a bit into it, and, you know, we have quite different strategies. And I was looking at her Twitter the other day, and you could go follow me on Twitter at @real_TianLee, no capitals. But I was looking, and I don't have many followers. So you could go follow me there. I made a Twitter page a long time ago, but I'm really inactive sometimes. And then sometimes I log on and tweet a few times, like bursts of tweets. You know, it's kind of like the relationship you have with your ex. You know, sometimes you're super active with them, and sometimes you don't talk for a very long time. That's kind of like me with Twitter. And so in Cathie Wood's Twitter, so Elon Musk was basically let me kind of take a step back. So Cathie Wood basically tweeted in the late 1800s and early 1900s, telephones, electricity, and the automobile were emerging. The U.S. equity market cap relative to GDP was about 2 to 3 times higher than it is today. And she's not really sure if it's true or not. She's not really sure if it's accurate or not, because it is really hard to get, because you didn't have all the technology we have today to track these things down. It's not as reliable as things are today. And of course, equity investing was a lot smaller than it is today. So you don't really know for sure what the numbers are, but she's guessing that the equity market cap relative to GDP was about 2 to 3 times higher than it is today. Now, I'm not sure if this is a nominal GDP or if it's real GDP, but I guess it doesn't, well, it matters, but I guess, you know, in this case, if you're saying it's going to be 2 to 3 times higher, it doesn't matter too much. Although you could be, you know, 10, 20%, you could get a 10, 20% difference. When you're talking about 2 to 3 times higher, that's like a 200, 300% difference. And so, you know, that was, I don't know if that was a reply to Elon Musk. Yeah, that was a reply to Elon Musk asking her, what do you think of the unusually high ratio of S&P 500 market cap to GDP? And that's kind of like the Buffett indicator. Now, the thing with the Buffett indicator is, you know, first of all, I think it's a pretty good measure. Now, there are some flaws. Like, if you could say that a lot of earnings from U.S. companies are made offshore. And so I'm not sure how much of that actually gets counted into the U.S. GDP. So you could argue that in that sense, you know, maybe offshore earnings have a different meaning than the S&P 500 market cap, because and the whole GDP thing, because you could be invested into U.S. companies that are in the S&P 500 that also have like foreign subsidiaries that make their money overseas. And so you have this kind of this problem where you don't know what to exactly count. But I mean, overall, it's still not a terrible indicator, and it's a pretty good warning sign, because if you look at how high it was back in 2001, well, I mean, soon after, what happened? Well, the whole tech bubble just came collapsing down. So I guess it, you know, it does have some flaws in every type of this type of indicators, I guess, has flaws. But it also serves some type of purpose, and it can be quite useful sometimes, especially to find overvalued markets or stocks. And so she goes on to say that the telephones, electricity, and the automobile, those were the three major technologies that were invented during the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And that's right. They were three very important inventions that really helped the world a lot. And of course, without a system where you could have all of this innovation, it would be very hard to do that. And so she was later talking about deflation. And so I like how she gets this part correctly. I mean, I get, you know, I think most people get this correctly anyways. And so she was saying that, you know, there was a lot of technological deflation, and a lot of it is good deflation. So, you know, as technology increases, you have an innovation increases, and you have higher productivity. And assuming that the price of your currency doesn't collapse or go down, so if you're printing too much money, or if you're just lowering interest rates artificially for no reason, as long as you're not doing this stuff and your productivity, I guess you could say, your ability to produce goods and services increases, then you're going to have natural deflation. And that is basically the price of your currencies go up relative to the price of stuff. And so you could go buy a cell phone and with $100. Well, I wish you could do that today. Let's say 1,000 years ago, you went and bought, not 1,000, what am I saying? 10 years ago, you go and buy a flip phone for $1,000, right? Not 1,000 years, $1,000. And so, I mean, you'd be buying a flip phone. That's terrible. That's, you know, today nobody would use a flip phone, but 10 years ago, I mean, that was quite common. I remember I didn't have a flip phone myself, but you know, I used my parents' flip phone. And I mean, look, it was not bad. You could play these little games on it. I don't know what the games are called, but there was this one little game that you could play on it that had you know, you're shooting stuff. I forgot what it's called. The point is, today you can do a lot more on a $1,000 phone. A flip phone today, I mean, it might still cost, well, it's not going to cost $1,000 to produce. Actually, it might, because no one produces it anymore. And so, but I mean, no one wants it. So it doesn't matter if it costs a lot to produce it anyways. And so all of this is naturally deflationary. And let's say you're farming and you are able to produce more crops more efficiently. And so you could lower your prices of crops, and you kind of have to, because if your competitor does it before you, or your competitor does it and you don't do it, then what happens is you're out of business. Your competitor wins all of the customers. They're offering the same quality or higher quality at you know, a lower price. And so that's a naturally deflationary aspect of capitalism, which is a great thing. And she calls it good deflation. And she's right about that. And she also comes and says bad deflation. And I assume what she's talking about is, well, right here she says it's people who are leveraging their balance sheets to repurchase shares of companies and to pay dividends. So that's basically, you know, like a company. I mean, you could think of it, instead of a stock or a public company, you could think of it as a private company. It's basically the same as someone taking out a loan. Let's say I owned a little hair salon. And with my hair salon, I go to the bank and take out a $10,000 business loan. And I go and buy jewelry with it, or I go and buy a TV with it, or I go and buy a car with it. That doesn't really help my productivity for my business at all. But I get to enjoy it personally, or maybe I take a vacation. Now, maybe right now is not a great time, but who knows? Maybe you could get some discounts on your vacation. So, I mean, you spent $1,000 or $10,000 on something that you enjoy, that you use for fun. And after, let's say your business goes bankrupt, or, you know, you go broke because you took on too much debt that you can't afford to pay back. And, you know, now you can't service the interest on your debt. And now your little hair salon declares bankruptcy, or just shuts down. So that's bad deflation. And it is bad deflation. And so, you know, a lot of things she's right about, but I still think she's a little bit too bullish on the whole, you know, innovation thing. And okay, so she's saying that deflation should lower the velocity of money. And okay. All right. So I think what's important is she is, you know, saying that, okay, this is interesting. So she says, this time is different are dangerous words. Now, I mean, you would expect someone who's super bullish in such a high valuation time to say, this time is different are dangerous words. But I guess she's saying it. And so she certainly expects the next few years to be the roaring 20s or be something like that. And so we'll have a lot of innovation. We'll have a lot of growth. We'll have a lot of, I don't know, maybe natural deflation. And now here's the thing with natural deflation. Usual natural deflation, here's the thing with inflation, deflation. You have to define it properly because it's really confusing if you don't define it properly, because what's inflation, what's deflation? It's hard to say. I mean, is it asset price inflation? Is it consumer price inflation or deflation? They're different things and they have different effects. And so, you know, if you're getting growth, if you're getting productive growth that's, you know, sustainable because of increased productivity, you're going to get consumer price deflation. You're going to get natural deflation, the good deflation that Kathy Wood is talking about. But you're going to get, at the same time, inflation. Now, the inflation you're going to be getting is not consumer price inflation. It's not the bad inflation. It's the asset price inflation, because your company is going to make more money. I mean, or maybe your company is not going to really grow that much if it's not a great company. But if it is a good company, then you're going to get asset price inflation on your company and probably also on the market as a whole. Unless if, I mean, I don't know what happens and you know, you get this kind of people moving out of equities and just buying all this stuff. You know, the point is that what I wanted to get to is kind of how I think she's a little bit too bullish. Now, I think in some areas, she is right. And so she goes on to talking about how the technologically enabled innovation evolving today dwarfs that of the late 1800s and 1900s. And the few she talks about was genomic sequencing, robotics, energy storage, artificial intelligence, and blockchain technology. And she also goes on to mentioning how Bitcoin could be today's gold standard. Now, I disagree with the second half for an interesting reason. Now, I think it's a common reason, and I think it's not necessarily a bad reason. And I could go on and talk about that forever, but I want to focus on the innovation part. And I guess Bitcoin's a part of this innovation. And here's the thing. I mean, if we're not going back to a gold standard, why would the US government adopt a Bitcoin standard? And look, here's the thing. No, this is sort of, you know, some people call this conspiracy, but at the same time, it's quite obvious. Okay, why did the U.S. go out there and attack Iran? Now, you know, there were purposes, and, you know, they say, it was to help the country and to, you know, fight terrorism and all of this. reduce the wars. But also, what did Iran do with the oil? Well, first of all, they obviously went off of the petrodollar system. And so they did not sell oil in U.S. dollars. I guess what happened? I mean, these guys went to war. All right, I was talking about Iraq, not Iran. They're different cases. And so, I mean, what is really preventing Bitcoin from being outlawed? Not much. And that's if Bitcoin works as a currency. And there's obviously a ton of other roadblocks preventing Bitcoin from becoming an actual good medium of exchange. And, for some reason, I mean, gold could be outlawed as well. That's possible too, especially if, inflation is running wild. Gold, Bitcoin, I mean, Bitcoin could obviously be outlawed, but gold, it's possible as well. It's harder to do, but it's still possible. And, that's why you have to be careful. That's why you have to, gold, it's still a speculation. Now, it's not necessarily a bad speculation, but Jerome Powell today, I think it was today, came out and said Bitcoin and gold is a speculation. And he's not wrong that it's a speculation. Now, it might be a good speculation, it might be a bad speculation, but it is a speculation. Now, some people say, gold is insurance, or it's this store of value, this safe haven asset. And that's true. It is if you're holding it for a very long period of time, like 30, 40, 50 years, sure, it's insurance, sure, it's store of value, but it's not insurance if you don't sell it, right? Because I mean, you're just it's more just savings if you're not going to sell it. Speculative, volatile savings if you're planning to sell it in 50 years. Now, Bitcoin is not it's very different from gold. They have similarities. They have a lot of them, but it's used completely differently than gold. And the two have a difference, and one has value, the other doesn't. And I don't want to talk too much about Bitcoin because that's not really what this episode's about. But I mean, I could go on forever. Now, what she's talking about, genomic sequencing, robotics, energy storage, AI, and blockchain. Personally, I'm not that familiar with these things. She's obviously a lot more technologically informed than I am. And so, I mean, maybe they could, maybe they do dwarf the innovation during the late 1800s and 1900s. But I think what's more important is, how do you put these things to work? How do you make these things profitable? And how do you make them useful enough so that they could actually be, first of all, profiting, and second of all, adding value to everyday life? Because that's how you make a profit. Now, some of the innovations we had back then was stuff like the oil pipeline, which was a big thing. I mean, now you could actually drill oil efficiently. There was the typewriter, the telephone. I mean, telephone's great, obviously. We had the light bulb, we had the camera, we had the gasoline-powered car. She was talking about automobiles, that's it. I mean, everyone's driving one today, or at least most people are. We got AC. If you don't care about air conditioning enough, I mean, you're going to regret in the summer. and we had the airplane. Well, we can't really use the airplanes now. We can, but not as much, unfortunately. But they were quite useful, and I think they will be quite useful as well. And we had the television, which I guess a lot of people are watching now. And we had the Ford Model T, which was the automobile that everybody could afford back in the day, where nobody could afford automobiles. And so these were obviously beneficial towards everyday life. And they really helped the average person. And then companies were able to produce these and benefit the customer and add value. What are we getting on to today? I mean, we came out with 5G quite recently. I guess quite recently, yeah. And I mean, 5G, 4G, it might be like a little bit faster. But I mean, what are you going to do with it? Watch a YouTube video on 4K? And if you're going to watch it on your phone, I mean, 1080p versus 4K, do phones even support 4K? I don't think many do. And I mean, I guess you could download a Netflix movie in maybe 10, 20 minutes instead of an hour or an hour and a half. I mean, I guess it serves a bit of purpose, but it's not like a total game changer. Whereas, when you went from 3G to 4G, I mean, that was a pretty big leap because you got HD in there, from non-HD to HD video. I mean, that's a big jump. And you could also make better calls. I mean, 5G, I don't know if it's that important. Now, I don't know tech that well. I don't know the whole technological aspect of 5G that well. I don't know what everything is behind it, but I mean, if you look at the basics, I don't think it's that big of a game changer. And because a phone, it doesn't matter if you have 5G, 6G, you're still better off using your computer if you want speed. So, or just raw power from your computer. So I think at one point there's kind of a glass ceiling where you have to, stop going down the same path and start innovating, start going through different paths, and start chasing different goals with your internet, so that you're no longer just trying to improve on the same thing. Because at one point, at a certain point, you get diminished returns. It's the law of diminishing returns. That's what you're getting with the whole 4G, 5G thing. And so, Kathy Wood's talking about stuff like genomic sequencing. Now, again, this is just taking the genes of stuff like animals. And actually, I'm not too familiar with this. I have to tell you. But here's the thing with whatever technology, whatever innovation, you have to keep in mind that it has to be used in a way that could serve at least a certain customer group a lot of purpose and deliver a lot of value. And finding information or being able to modify animals or robots or having new AI, I think it's really, I think there's a lot of room to grow But at the same time, you have to have a customer base that needs these things. And so I want to go back to kind of the late 1800s and the early 1900s and kind of talk about the whole macroeconomic situation there, because that was also different as well. And so back then they were going through the Industrial Revolution, and during that time they had huge, huge growth, and it was real growth. It was not just, it was not, I mean, it was real growth. It was deflation, CPI, and inflation, asset prices. I guess, you know, here's the thing with inflation, deflation. Inflation, I mean, you would say increase in asset prices. I mean, inflation doesn't even make sense. Like the word saying inflating asset price, that alone doesn't even make sense. So I'll just say increasing, decreasing. And, you know, deflating asset prices, I don't think that makes much sense. But just lowered, you know, consumer prices or lowered asset prices. So back then they had asset prices that were increasing, and real, you know, the price of real goods and services, consumer prices decreasing. So that's the good deflation. And the good inflation, I guess, the good increase in price of assets that that's like the perfect combination. And something with back then is, first of all, we had a much better economy. We're going through the Industrial Revolution. We had lower taxes. We had lower regulations. And the whole economy was a lot less financialized. Today, I mean, everything's financialized. We have all types of derivatives. It doesn't matter what you want, you got it. We have stuff like crypto. We have stuff like Bitcoin. I mean, blockchain. You're trading NFTs. Anything can be financialized today. Back then, not much was financialized. And most people were in private equity. They were starting their own business. It wasn't publicly traded. So everybody had their own little businesses, and everybody, there were a lot of entrepreneurs. There were a lot of, I mean, there were a lot less big companies and that had a lot of employees. But, you know, they were, there were some big companies, and especially the auto manufacturers. But employees, most of them, they didn't go out and buy stocks or whatever other financial assets. I think some of them bought bonds, some bought stocks, but back then there wasn't much public equity in the first place. And I think another very important factor is not many people knew what stocks were, and most people cared about the dividends and the income that they got from, well, they mostly had private equity. But if they were to have stocks, most people cared about the dividends from the stock, and, you know, they cared about the capital gains as well. But they didn't really know what capital, I mean, they didn't know how to get them. And so they just randomly traded them. And, you know, actually I have this book with me right here, The Intelligent Investor. And I don't know why I'm flashing it. And it says that it was published in 1949. And in the book, it basically tells you that, well, I guess Ben Graham is saying that, you know, before, you know, what he witnessed was just people randomly trading stocks. They didn't know what stocks were. They were just randomly trading them. I think I read somewhere that the stocks with the cool ticker symbols would go up. because, you know, people thought they would be lucky if they bought a stock with a cool ticker symbol. And so if it was a good ticker symbol, it must be, you know, it must be a great stock. So they would buy stocks just based off of ticker symbols. And that's kind of what we have today. I mean, why are people getting into GameStop? Now, I guess that the craze has kind of moved on a little bit. But still, I mean, it's still just a terrible speculation. And so, I mean, people didn't really know what stocks were. And so whether it's overvalued or undervalued or high PE, low PE, people didn't care back then. And, you know, Ben Graham, that's why Ben Graham came in. He started picking stocks with low PEs. And back then it was a lot way easier to do, you know, value investing, because you could find companies with, I think, more cash, more, I don't know if it was cash or if it was, or if it was, let me think. I don't know if it was more cash or if it was more net current assets than the whole market cap of the company. But I mean, either one of the two, it wouldn't make any sense in today's day. I guess today's day, I mean, it's kind of crazy anyways. So, I mean, does it really matter? I don't know, but you wouldn't really find anything like that today, because right now everything is the market is a lot more efficient than it was back then, when nobody really understood it, when there were a lot few players in the game. And so you had a less efficient market. Today, it's still not perfectly efficient at all. And stuff like, you know, GameStop, there's nothing justifies its price. But I think in the long term, it's still quite efficient. And at the same time, you have to realize that back then there was a lot less debt. I mean, nowadays companies, a lot of them are funding their dividends, like Kathy Wood just said, dividends and their stock buybacks with debt. They were taking on all of this debt. And a lot of their income growth is because of debt. You know, they're able to increase their, let's say, their marketing campaigns, or they're able to take on bigger, let's say it's some type of hedge fund. I know they're not publicly traded, but let's say, you know, let's just talk about a hedge fund. They're able to take on a lot more leverage. And well, if you make money, you're going to make a lot more money. But what happened to, what was his name, Bill Huang, the guy from Archegos Capital? Well, this guy, he went bust. He took on too much leverage. He took on too much debt. And, you know, when you have the fastest growth in history, like you did in the late 1800s, to the early 1900s, you didn't have nearly as much debt as you do today. And eventually, well, you're probably going to have to pay it back. And if you're going to have to pay it back, you're not going to have the fastest growth in history. Again, you're probably not going to have it. And also, what's allowing the debt to go so high is the interest rates. And interest rates back then were a lot higher. They were a lot higher than they are today. Today, I mean, what's going to let stock prices go up even higher? I mean, even lower interest rates? Or I mean, what's going to happen? Are negative interest rates? Is that going to happen? So with all this, the macro outlook is not very good. And back then, unlike now, I mean, now we just had Coinbase's IPO. And, you know, at one point it was worth more than like $100 billion worth of market cap. So that, I mean, that was, I mean, that's putting Coinbase, the company's valuation, higher than Goldman Sachs. And I mean, I don't know what could justify that. I mean, it must be very optimistic people, like Kathy Wood. So, you know, crypto bulls must be really liking Coinbase for them to value it that highly. And of course, today we're getting all these unprofitable IPOs like DoorDash and Airbnb. Whereas, you know, back in the day when you had IPOs, I mean, they were all profitable. If you had an unprofitable IPO, I mean, people would think you're crazy. You know, nobody would buy the you know, initial public offering. And I mean, it would basically be a worthless IPO. But nowadays, people are paying crazy prices for, you know, companies that are not making any money, that a lot of them don't seem like they will be making a lot of money in the future. You know, something like DoorDash. If it's not making money now, when everybody is stuck at home and nobody wants to go out, is it going to make money when people want to go out? I mean, that's common sense. And of course, when you have all of this political struggle where, you know, these Uber drivers are now forced to be employees and be paid minimum wages and all of this. Well, what's going to happen to the Uber Eats drivers? What's going to happen to the DoorDash drivers? Probably the same thing, because they're very similar occupations. And so you have all these unprofitable IPOs, but back then IPOs were actually profitable. If you look at stuff like Microsoft, or I don't know, Facebook, who else had an IPO? Apple, you know, the tech companies of back in the day. You compare them to the tech companies today, well, they're completely different. And so all of this optimism is what fuels these very overvalued IPOs. And maybe, you know, maybe all of this technology that evolves in future, maybe it's going to change the whole world. Maybe, you know, everyday individuals are going to be impacted a lot. Maybe, you know, it's going to be the next automobile, or the next telephone, or electricity. Maybe it's going to be even bigger than that. I don't know. But in the short term, it doesn't seem like the best investment, especially because you're paying a very high price for things that you don't necessarily, probably don't understand. And you have to realize, back then when they were making automobiles, in the United States alone, and this fact is probably, I mean, I hope it blows your mind, there were 1,900 different automobile companies, American, in the, you know, during the 1920s era. 1,900 different auto companies. And today there's American companies, there's basically just three: Ford, GM, and Chrysler, from 1900. And so, I mean, how do you pick three out of 1900? How do you know which ones are the ones that are going to become the next big auto manufacturers? And I guess today, I mean, you could argue that you could just buy an index of all the small ones. But if you know, three out of 1900 make a lot of money and the rest go completely bankrupt, I mean, are you really going to be pocketing home a lot of money, especially when the whole industry is overvalued? You know, you're hardly going to be pocketing any money if you take that strategy, because I mean, so many companies are going to be failing that you don't know which ones are going to succeed. You know, it's a highly speculative industry if you're picking, let's say, individual companies. And even if you're picking indexes, it's still very risky, because a lot of the companies in the index is going to fail. Same with if, you know, you're picking random companies in a, you know, in a junior mining sector, if you're talking about mining or biochemistry, if you're picking some random company that's trying to find the cure for cancer, a lot of them are going to be wrong. And if one finds it, well, that's going to be, you know, revolutionary, but there's a much higher chance of most of them not being revolutionary. And again, it could work out very well, and I hope it does. But right now, especially when the whole market seems to be overvalued, at least the macroeconomic aspect looks like it's overvalued. And you know, value is based off of future earnings. Right now, it doesn't seem like the immediate future earnings look too great. First of all, if you look at the macroeconomic fundamentals that I just talked about, and if you look at how these companies aren't actually selling much to consumers, to customers, they're in the innovative process, but they're not actually in the, you know, the process where they're selling a lot of stuff, because that's where they make all the money. And, you know, I think to wrap this up, I think the whole, you know, innovative industry or the growth industry, you know, it might work. I don't think right now is a great time. And it's just very, very speculative. Now, I think if things play out, and you know, it takes time to see what will work, what won't. And once you go with the time, you'll get a much better view on how things are developing. And I think, you know, all these innovations you should keep an eye on, but not necessarily put your money in. And so that is all for today. And yeah, go follow me on Twitter at @real_TeonLee. I need some Twitter followers. I don't have many, so make sure to check that out. Thank you.